Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Your Ben Jarofsky Show for Tuesday, November 30th is just moments away. But before we do this, let's thank our sponsors. SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana.
I'm sick of it!
The Chicago Federation of Labor.
I'm sick of it!
The Chicago Teachers Union.
I'm sick of it!
And of course, Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for all things there is to know the city of Chicago, where to go, what to do, what to eat, what to drink, what kind of pot to smoke, and so much more, including columns from our very own Ben Jarofsky. Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com. And if you want to help out this program, you can, chicagoreader.com/Jarofsky, J-O-R-A, V as in victory, S-K-Y. It is Tuesday, November 30th, and live from my apartment and his attic, this is the Ben Jarofsky Show. Today on the program, it's a city council synopsis with the one, the only, Mr. Bike, yeah, and Mr. City Council, Dave Glowatz. And now your host, Mr. Attic Guy, Chicago Raider columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky. We're calling this Jussie's Back Tuesday, and here's why. Because Jussie's back. Jussie Smollett. You thought Smollett Gate had gone away, ladies and gentlemen? It's on the front page of both newspapers. Here you go, D. We haven't done this in a while. By the way, I'm going to save a lot of this up because Dennis and I are going to have a field day on Friday when we do what a week it was. Actually, there's no more was, but whatever. Oh, what a week. All right, here you go, D. Just to see how good you are, if you're on your toes. Tribune versus Sun-Time headline battle.
Oh, right each, on.
Each paper.
Battle of the headlines, but go ahead.
You could just edit that out. Just edit it. So battle of the headline. What did I say?
Headline battle.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, the Tribunal or the Sun-Times, each thought was... Of all the news in the world, it was very important to put Jussie Smollett on the front page of the paper, ladies and gentlemen. This story has become a farce. This story has become a caricature of itself. The fact that so much emphasis is being put on Jussie Smollett's crimes against humanity. We're spending so much money prosecuting, so much police time was spent investigating, and now... Let's go get them. And I'm reading Andy Grimm, who I think does the best job of covering this of anybody in the city of Chicago from the Chicago Sun-Times, saying that he'll probably get off with probation. Are you kidding me? After all this? Well, it gives us something to talk about and entertains us, and it gives us an opportunity to play Battle of the Headlines.
Oh, man.
Here we go.
That's cool. That noise like is awesome. That, yeah. I really do like that.
I worked it out. Was Phil? Wait, who's the person in our special effects department? I forgot her name.
Can't even remember her name, huh? My gosh.
Sally Sue? I think Sally Sue was the one who came up with that.
It's all just right, so me, guys.
The Chicago Tribune headline, a picture of Jussie Smollett with his mask on, looking very dignified in a tie. And the headline is Smollett Trial Begins. Smollett Trial Begins. Okay, that's the headline in the Tribunal. My beloved Bright One, home delivered every day.
Brother, here we go. This...
Villain or victim?
I was expecting no puns. I was expecting a pun.
Yeah, no pun. Let's see if we're... let's see if we go inside. No, it's a snoozer on the inside. Jury chosen for Smollett trial. Come on, Bright One, wake up. All right. Anyway, so which one do you like better, D?
I mean, I'm a sucker. I'm not really sure of the rest of the articles, but I'm a sucker for those Tribune headlines.
Yeah, they're Smollett trial begins. It's they're spending so much money on that trial. Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And the police manpower. Good God. I mean, they were really eager to prove him wrong. And they've mounted such a overwhelming case against the guy. And meanwhile, his lawyer is saying it wasn't him. He's the victim. Okay. Anyway, that's the story. We'll probably be talking about that later this week. Also, we'll be talking about Rodney Davis. We like to keep you guys up to date on what MAGA is doing in the state of Illinois. Now, Rodney Davis declared, I don't know if you saw this, Dave, that Rodney Davis is not Congressman Rodney Davis. He was sort of kind of like the mild-mannered Republican. The Republicans realize they need to run if they're going to win in a blue state against an incumbent governor, the kind of thing that they did in Virginia, where you get a mild-mannered Republican who just says just enough MAGA stuff to convince MAGA he's okay without alienating MAGA, but not too far so that, like, suburbanites who hate taxes and want a Republican that'll cut their taxes go, I like this guy. So that was their Rodney Davis was their candidate. He's a congressman, mild mannered guy. Hey, I'm Rodney. Well, it turns out he's running for re-election. And you know what? The Democratic map was set up to guarantee this. They dangled this district in front of him. Here you go, Rodney. Look at the district. Look at the district. It's so favorable to you. Why run against Pritzker? He's got all that money. And then, Kenny G in the background, Kenny Griffith, you know, who has threatened to bankroll any Republican running against JB, is like, I got money too. But nope, it looks like Rodney Davis is going to run for Congress, which means he's going to run against, looks like he's going to run against Mary Miller. I'm basing this everything on what Lynn Sweet said in today's Bright One. Lynn Sweet, political columnist for the Bright One. So that will be interesting. Can a mild manner Republican defeat a red-blooded MAGA Republican in a Republican primary? I don't know. I don't care how favorable that district is made for Rodney Davis, because all the quote-unquote swing voters and the Democrats are going to be voting, who might be open to vote voting for him, will be participating in the Democratic primary. So I don't know. That's going to be a very interesting one. We'll be watching that and talking about that. I got to tell you, D, I didn't tell you this. I did tell you this. It was my birthday or last week. Yes. Thank you, everybody. I am now 38. And sure. As a birthday. Yeah, I know. I look good for 38. Yeah. I'm around 38. I've been around 38 twice. anyway, got a laugh out of it. I got two laughs out of Dennis today. Anyway, for my birthday present, my wife bought me five Bulls hats. So people may say, Ben, you got a problem. And I'm going, no, I don't have a problem. Well, maybe I do have a problem, but I don't care if I have that problem. So I'm wearing one of my new Bulls hats. Dennis is looking at it, likes it. So I got five of them.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I spent the long Thanksgiving weekend, because we didn't do a show Friday. So it was a long weekend. I spent most of it seemed like watching the Beatles documentary. And so this, of course, is the documentary that's on, Disney, where, thank you, Frank, by the way. Thanks to Frank, I have access to Disney. The Beatles shot, there was a lot of footage shot back in 1969 when the Beatles were recording Let It Be, and they were doing it for the documentary that eventually came out called Let It Be. And there were hundreds of hours of footage left over, and somebody discovered, I don't know who, and Peter Jackson, the great director, decided he would put it together as his own documentary. He got the blessing of Yoko Ono and Olivia Harrison, George Harrison's widow, and Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. And I'll tell you what, folks, this is not for the faint of heart. You got to be a diehard Beatle fan to go there. The first 2 hours of this documentary is like shots of Ringo falling asleep. They're in a studio. They're waiting. Like, they're waiting around for John Lennon, who's always late for every rehearsal. And so they're just sitting there, and just time is ticking. Tick, and they just show Ringo Starr just kind of drifting off. I'm like, man. This documentary, requires a certain amount of allegiance and love and adoration for the Beatles. That's for sure. And but I soldiered through and loved every, well, I can't say I loved every minute. I really enjoyed the last part of it. So we'll probably be talking about that with Ramon Hussein. She's been dutifully watching it as well. And we'll be talking to Justice Smollett with Ramona later in this week, and Andy Grimm. So we'll be following all these stories that I just talked about later on the wing. Today, we're going to be talking with Dave Glowatz. Mr. Bike, Mr. City Council. Young Dave Glowatz has joined us, the man better known as Mr. Bike, or sometimes known as Mr. City Council from inside Chicago government. Welcome back, Cotter.
It's great to be here.
All right. As has become our practice over the last several shows featuring Dave, I am not aware of the cuts he has set up to play. He's got five of them. I think we'll get through all five. Five cuts from recent city council meetings. I have no idea what they are. I don't know who is going to be speaking. This is pure improv on my part. Am I nervous? A little bit. Okay, a little bit.
You don't look nervous.
look at my hand. It's steady. But I shoot with this one. Sorry. It's from Blazing Saddles, an old movie. Bad joke. All right, Dave. So without further ado.
I love it when you speak French. Today we're going to hear parts of the full city council meeting that took place on November 17. Plus we'll hear several excerpts from other city council activity. And we'll hear from a meeting of the Chicago Police Board, which I'd call a quasi-judicial body appointed by the mayor that has final say on discipline of individual police officers. Dennis, please, we're going to do a point first. At the beginning of the November 17 city council meeting, Ben, the city clerk, as usual, read a series of measures introduced by Mayor Lori Lightfoot. We're going to hear the clerk announce one such measure and then say which committee would consider it. At that point, as we've discussed in the past, any alderman could call out a different committee, which would then send the measure to the Rules Committee, thereby adding one more step and slowing down the measure. That's what happened here. After that, we'll hear the mayor's reaction at a press conference. Then finally, we'll hear part of a speech at the November 18 meeting of the Chicago Police Board. Let's listen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have appointed Andrea Kirsten as the Chief Administrator of the Civilian Office of Police Accountability. Favorable consideration of this appointment will be appreciated. Refer to the Committee on Public Safety. Two committees are being called, the Committee on Public Safety and Committee on Housing. The matter is referred to the Committee on Committees and Rules.
As we've seen, unfortunately, over the course of the last year in particular, predictable people do predictable things. So the fact that somebody sent that nomination to Rules, not a shock whatsoever. And in fact, I gave Andrea a heads up that that was likely a possibility because we see, unfortunately, how some members of the council have used the procedural tools as a cudgel instead of trying to work productively. Andrea Kirsten deserves a hearing. I think she's the most qualified person of the applicants that were put forward to me. Now, having said that, I've been very clear. I thought it didn't make sense for COPA to put out a recent report that had Officer French's name in it. It was tone deaf, and it was absolutely unnecessary. So I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say. I'm aware that she's going to be making some kind of statement tomorrow at the police board, but she's got a lot to do and explain to the members of the city council why she is best qualified to move from the acting role to the full-time chief administrator of COPA.
I have profound regret and sadness that the work of our agency has in any way hurt the French family and those who mourn her. And I will work steadfastly to ensure that a situation such as this never happens again. There is more that COPA could have done to message publicly the timeline and the circumstances surrounding Officer French's inclusion in our report. COPA did not and never would make a posthumous disciplinary recommendation against any officer, and we did not do so against Officer Ella French. All disciplinary recommendations COPA made in this matter were made on April 27th, 2021, when our investigation was concluded and the summary report and file were sent to the Chicago Police Department. COPA also had an obligation to publish its report of investigation when and how we did under our ordinance, the consent decree, and applicable FOIA provisions. COPA had an obligation to the timely and transparent release of our report, which we did on November 10th, 2021. Let us remember that there was profound public pressure surrounding COPA's investigation into the raid on Ms. Anjanette Young's home, but COPA still followed its process. Part of that process meant we were unable to immediately release our report in April while we awaited the superintendent's 90-day review and service of discipline against officers. When we release reports to the public, COPA does not alter or redact more information than the law permits. Unless prohibited by court order or other law, despite a family's wishes, COPA adheres to the mandated policy and releases the information. This is a difficult job. And to do it well, we must make a commitment not to be swayed by public opinion, political pressure, or personal emotion, but to adhere to all of the mandates that govern our agency. Transparency is vital to public trust, but it only works when it's consistent. I would welcome a conversation to examine a process for ensuring a situation like this never happens again. Furthermore, there are opportunities here for COPA to share with the police department our approach for engaging impacted civilians and their families as they navigate this complex oversight system. These conversations could help the department to develop practices for how and when officers and their families are notified of COPA's transparency releases, and what role, if any, COPA could play in that process.
Shall I give a little background?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, the former chief of this acronym we keep hearing, COPA, the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, which is the agency that investigates, independent agency that investigates most police misconduct that involves the public. Her name was, the former chief was Sydney Roberts, but Ms. Roberts resigned in May, after which Mayor Lightfoot appointed a woman named Andrea Kirsten as the interim chief. Fast forward to November, when COPA released its recommendations for discipline of police officers involved in the improper raid of the Chicago woman named Anjanette Young. And one of the police officers who received a recommendation of discipline was Officer Ella French, who later died in the line of duty this year. And the confluence events, the death of Ms. French and the release of the report stating that she should receive discipline for her role in the raid, touched off a big firestorm, which resulted, among other things, a letter from 20 Chicago aldermen urging the mayor not to recommend Andrea Kirsten as the new chief of COPA because she was involved in the authoring of that set of recommendations.
Yes. Are you done with your cursory explanation? All right. I want to weigh in. You know, I started this show by talking about what a joke the Jussie Smollett case is. But this is sort of an extension about this. This is politics in the criminal justice system, mayoral politics, aldermanic politics all coming together. And to set up convenient straw men that you can knock down and look good to your constituency, knocking them down, people who already agree with you. So in this particular case, the improper—is I think that was the word you used—raid on Anjanette Young's house. That's what this story's. I can't believe it's been a full year. This thing hasn't been resolved yet. So back in 2019, ladies and gentlemen, about 12 Chicago police officers conducted a raid on Anjanette Young's home on the west side of Chicago. Anjanette Young has been on the show. If you want to hear more about it from her point of view, you can go track down the interview. She was completely unaware that the raid was coming, and she'd been taking a shower, and she stepped out of her shower stark naked. It was her house, after all, at roughly the same time the police came barging through the front door. I would say within a minute, police could have realized that they had the wrong house, which is what the case was. They had the wrong address. But nope, they kept that thing going for a while. I forget how many minutes.
She was 40 at least.
40 minutes naked. Yeah. Dave Savini, a shout out one more time. Every time I talk about this, you got to give Dave Savini credit. from Channel 2 News. This is one of those stories that if you don't have a bulldog reporter constantly reporting it, it'll get buried. Just like the sex scandal at the Park District, if it wasn't for Danny Mealopoulos, that story would have been buried. That's how we do it in Chicago. If they hadn't gone to court to force Mayor Rahm kicking and screaming every step of the way to give up the Laquan McDonald video, that story would have been buried.
He might be our mayor.
Yes, he. Oh God. Yes, he probably would. No, he would have run again, and the citizens of Chicago, with great moments in their electoral history, would have voted for him again. So anyway, we see this obvious case, thanks to Dave Savini, of police. What? It was a mistake. OK, I'll give him that. But they went too far with it. They were very cruel to her. Ironically, the one police officer, according to Andrea Young, who showed some humaneness, some common sense, was Ella French. Ella French was later, as Dave said, shot, killed. I think it was this September. Well, meanwhile, there's a report. The city of Chicago is doing its own investigations, taking its time, really would have buried it. There would have been nothing if it wasn't for Dave Savini, but they're forced to because it's such an outrageous videotape that everybody saw. They're forced to. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, by the way, she it's so funny that she's grandstanding on this one because I still have, Dave, I still have. I will not throw it away. The press release. I'm showing Dave Glowatz the press release right now. Well, Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, and I quote, "Today I became aware of an incident involving Miss Anjanette Young from February 2019 before I became mayor, and I saw a video today for the first time. I had no knowledge of either until today." What? Not true. We subsequently learned, oops, that wasn't true. So the mayor, I got to give her credit. Whenever she says something that's not true or makes her look bad, she's really good at changing the subject. So they did this investigation. And they put in the truth, which is that Ella French was written up for her role in the raid, even though she was the kindest police officer that day to Anjanette Young. She was written up for her role. That's a fact, ladies and gentlemen.
If I may interject, I believe, according to the reports, Officer French stopped a person on the street on the way into the raid, and she didn't report it. And that's technically what she got cited for.
Yeah, she was. And I think she didn't have her police camera on. The point is this. She was written up. It was an investigation and they wrote her up. And so now what? You're supposed to edit the official investigation? I've already talked about this. My point of view is you can't edit an official investigation. You can't take things out of it. We're supposed to be a transparent city. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said, what did she say? I'm going to let the light shine. Isn't that what she said or something like that? Well, the light will shine. It will be the most transparent city, which is really funny because I thought under Mayor Rahm, we were going to be the most transparent city. It's funny. We have all these mayors dedicated to transparency and they bury anything that would make them look bad. And it's only because of bulldog reporters like Danny Mealopoulos and Dave Savini that we ever see this stuff.
Well, in the mayor's defense, Ben, if the mayor actually thought that Ms. Kirsten was negligent or incompetent, she wouldn't have nominated her to be the permanent head of COPA. So she did. But she tried to have it both ways, one could say, by saying that by naming French in the report, it was, quote, tone deaf, unquote.
How is that in the defense of the mayor? Well, what you just said made her look even worse.
She's not going as far as these 20 aldermen who say, no, this woman, Ms. Kirsten, does not deserve to be head of COPA because of that. What they view as an atrocity, an impropriety, to put it mildly.
Well, I hardly think that's a ringing defense. If that's her best defense, good God.
But she's standing behind Ms. Kirsten.
Yeah.
The mayor standing behind Ms. Kirsten as her chief of COPA.
While, to your point, having it both ways, sort of criticizing Ms. Kirsten and saying we'll do things differently later. And I'm like, what would you do differently? Now, my suggestion, which of course, since I made it, would never be followed, would be that, you know what? You could write an appendage to the report that say subsequently, Ella French died in the line of duty. And Anjanette Young has praised her. You could put something like that in there.
The report came out in April. And Officer French died in September.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that subsequently, after she died, are you aware of that report, you could put an appendage. And you could do that if you wanted. But you shouldn't take out, you shouldn't eradicate public information. That'd be like in Chinatown, your favorite movie, which is still, by the way, this really part of Chinatown really irritates me. I know we're in a tangent, Dave, but the part where Jack Nicholson goes to the Board of Records, and he, do you remember this part? And he's got all the records of the lands. Wait, hold it. Time out. What did you just say?
I was asleep that year.
You did not see Chinatown?
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Leave this room right
Bye.
Now.
Bye.
No, don't go anywhere. Right here, right? You're on show today. You can't go anywhere. Anyway, in Chinatown, Jack Nicholson, Ken Davis is listening. He remembers this. He might be the only other guy in Chicago who's seen Chinatown, where Jack Nicholson rips all the names out of the board, the record book, because he wants to have it to track down. I'm like, you can't do it. I remember watching. You can't do that. I was like 18. You can't do that. So it's very
so transparency when transparency is convenient. That's the question here.
Yes, very well done. Transparency when transparency is convenient. So they're all playing politics, and Andrea Kirsten, as we saw, was trying to get her way out of it by sort of playing politics as well. And,
well, I think she made a really good proposal that she said there are already protocols. I'm paraphrasing. She said there are already protocols around breaking to families of victims of violence or, you know, of murder, breaking to them easily and with compassion the news of investigative reports. And she suggested that the police department implements similar protocols when talking to families of killed police officers. So I think that seems like a very reasonable proposal.
Yes. Very reasonable proposal. But I still think we're heading down a dangerous path if we're going to start talking about rewriting public documents and public records for political convenience, particularly when we're supposed to be emphasizing how we're a transparent city.
Well, Kirsten, to me, did not seem like she was proposing that.
No.
So to her credit.
Yeah, to her credit. Yes. There you go. That works. To her.
You don't want me. You don't want me giving any credit to the mayor. I see what's going on.
Yes, she doesn't deserve credit for her role in this. Nothing at all.
Well, this next one might make me feel a little more sympathetic towards the mayor. I don't know.
All right, go ahead.
Dennis, please, we're going to do cry next. Well, continuing with the November 17 meeting of the full city council, on that same day, this wasn't at the council meeting, but on the same day, the mayor announced executive order number 2021-3 titled Establishment of Interagency Reentry Council. This multi-department effort aims to make it easier for people released from prison to return to their home communities in terms of finding jobs and other support. We're going to hear an excerpt from the mayor's press conference after the November 17 city council meeting. It starts with 27th Ward Alderman Walter Burnett, and who is followed by the mayor. Let's listen.
As some of you may or may not know, I'm a returning citizen. God has blessed me to redeem myself and contribute back to society. There are so many people out in society who need those opportunities, and everyone needs some help. I want to commend the mayor and the working group that I've been on trying to come up with policies to try to help folks to get their lives back together. I just want to thank God first for the opportunity to be here and stand before you and say that. But also I want to thank the mayor. She didn't have to go this far. She didn't have to work on putting something in place to make sure that folks, family members who are coming back into society, get an opportunity to get some help.
Alderman Burnett, every time you speak, I
feel incredibly emotional. You always make me on the verge of tears because of what a good person you are, but how heartfelt everything is that you do. So I really, really want to tell you how much I appreciate you.
So, Ben, you might recall that months ago we heard a city council speech by Alderman Burnett complimenting the mayor on a different matter, after which the mayor said that his remarks made her cry. Now, I think it's you that called, you and others called the mayor hard-headed. What are other words you used? It's not someone who's given to sentiment, I guess. So in my memory, there isn't any other alderman who has made any mayor at all cry, let alone Mayor Lightfoot. And what we're getting now is that Alderman Burnett makes the mayor cry on a regular basis. So I just thought it was remarkable.
Are you suggesting that those tears are of the crocodile?
She sounds like writing? She means it. The two times I've heard her say it. She sounds choked up, and I don't know.
We talk quite a bit about Mayor Lori Lightfoot's acting skills on this show. There's a bit that Dennis likes to play from last Thanksgiving. If you recall, last Thanksgiving, when the mayor issued all that edict that we were not to have Thanksgiving dinners with our loved ones.
The phone call with Mom.
Yes. Was it Mom? Yeah. And you know it well. And so there's that moment where you don't hear the other end of the conversation, which has led some people to suspect that there is nobody on the other end and that she's merely playing, second reference of the day, Bob Newhart, where he's just talking into a telephone. There are some people who've suggested that. Now, I'm not saying who those people are, but there are those people who have suggested that it's not a real phone conversation. And then there's that moment where it's that pause and the sigh. Okay. And she goes, the sigh. So I'm starting to think that Mayor Lori Lightfoot is, what is it, a bit of a thespian? Isn't that what they're called? Mm-hmm. Actors. That she's just a frustrated actor and would like to, someday we may see her on the screen. Performing. I got to say this. I'm going to give Walter Burnett credit for one thing. He got the order right. If you're going to thank things in the universe, you would start with God and then go to the mayor. You wouldn't. I was for a second, I was going to worry he was going to thank Mayor Lightfoot first and then get to God. I go, no, God is greater than the mayor. So thankfully, he has his priorities in order. Thank you, Alderman Burnett.
So it sounds like you're not giving him any credit for this. Being a tearjerker.
No, Walter Burnett is a very interesting man, but it is true. He was blessed, and I do believe that he has a sense of that because he got off to a rough start in life, if you will. And once he got out of prison, he did well for himself and became the alderman of 27th Ward. I believe he's the alderman since 1993. Don't quote me on that, but for a long time.
That would make many people cry.
Yeah, maybe 1995. I can't remember when he was first elected alderman. It was in the 90s. And I just got to go back to something, though, from the Rules Committee, which, again, gets at the heart of Mayor Lori Lightfoot being genuine. So you said, I was going to get to this, and then we moved to the Walter Burnett praising God and praising the mayor in that order. Thank you, Walter Burnett. Good God, if you had reversed it, would have. There was an alderman, Claude Holman, who would thank God for Mayor Daley. This goes back to the 70s and the 60s. Claude Holman, fourth ward alderman, he would thank, not baby Daley millennials that you knew about when you were growing up, but his father. And Claude Holman would thank God for having Chicago being blessed with a great mayor like Mayor Daley. So this is kind of a tradition of aldermen invoking the Lord when talking about mayors. That was like unbelievable performance by Lori Lightfoot. So obviously there was an attempt by some aldermen to take Andrea Kirsten's appointment. This is going back to this conversation left over from the last part of the last segment. Send it to the Rules Committee, not deal with it then. And if you send it to Rules Committee, then you have to have a special meeting of the Rules Committee to bring it out of Rules Committee. And the mayor is just outraged. And she said, that people predictable. This is predictable behavior by these aldermen who aren't serious, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, if you care so much about this as a why do you use it? Mayors have been using the rules committee as a dumping ground for years. Now the aldermen who are often opposed to the mayors are starting to use it. Here's a radical suggestion that I'm going to throw out. Radical, and we're going to ask Dave Glowatz to take a position on this. I love watching him squirm when I make him take a position on something. So here's a radical suggestion. How about having a legitimate rules committee, which meets on a regular basis and discusses the proposals that have been dumped there, as opposed to having the rules committee as a receptacle, a waste paper basket, where you dump things and then never empty it until it overflows. Dave Glowatz, your thoughts?
This is a trivia question for you. How many members of the Rules Committee are there?
By the way, that was a very brilliant duck. Did you notice how effectively?
That was a segue.
That was answering a question with a question.
Yeah, what do you turn to that? I'm a journalist.
I have no idea how many members in the Rules Committee. This is something I should know.
Just for our listeners' benefit, you know, there are, you know, what, 20-odd committees? And the method by which members of the city council get to be on those committees is probably something we shouldn't go into, but you know, the membership varies. Like there can be like a dozen, there could be 20. I think one of the larger committees is finance. The rules committee is the only committee of which every alderman is a member.
Oh, I think I did know that, but forgot it.
Yeah. That's an easy thing to forget. Cause it's like, what number? Well, it's 50, you know, 50. Yes.
And so, Michelle Smith is the chair.
Harris.
Michelle Smith is an ally. Michelle Harris. Harris, my bad. Yeah, Michelle Harris of the 8th.
Do you know the difference between their first names?
Yeah, one is two L's and the other is one.
Yeah, Harris is two.
Yeah. And that always, oh, God, don't get me into spelling.
Well, you got that one right. Yeah, you're on a roll. I won't ask you anymore.
And on a tangent, within a tangent, this is one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made was recently. It's not funny, except it's funny. I said five people were killed. I was talking about an incident that took place. Five people were killed. And then I listed the people killed and there were six. And so somebody sent me an email. It's not funny, but it was funny. He goes, did you get your math skills at Evanston High School? And I was like, yes, as a matter of fact. But, you know, so Michelle Harris is put in charge of that committee by the mayor. Yes, the mayor selects the chairs of the committee, complete violation of separation of powers in the city of Chicago. And as such, her role is to have meetings when the mayor wants to have meetings and to not have meetings when the mayor doesn't want to have meetings, so that you could use the rules committee as a burial ground for legislation the mayor doesn't want. And yet when another alderman who's against the mayor sends one of her ideas to rules, you quickly get it back to the full city council.
But if I remember correctly, that the longest it could, well, not the longest, but there's an opportunity after 2 months for an alderman who has a measure buried in the rules committee to find another alderman. Is that right? Find another alderman to move to have it taken out of the rules committee and brought before the council. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you have it right. But my basic point is this. If you want to end this practice, which I think should be ended, I think you should have a legitimate debate.
Yeah, it's a roadblock.
Issues. Yeah. If you want to end it, then have the rules committee meet on a regular basis to review all legislation in the rules committee. And that, at which point people will stop using the rules committee as a burial ground. There you go. But you don't criticize it when some people do it and then do it yourself. Now that would, again, that's why you say, oh, Ben, you're so unfair to the mayor. Those are real tears she was crying. And that was real indignation that she was sounding when she chastised. What was it, Raylo, who sent it to the rule?
I forgot to mention, the target of her ire was 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez, who reportedly is the one who called out the housing committee for this appointment to go to. I was like, I'll just pick one, you know?
Yeah, just
Copa. How's it?
Sure. Yeah, Copa Cabana. One of Dave Glowatz's
there
favorite.
There you go. I hadn't thought of that. Of course, that's what he's thinking of. Yeah.
So anyway, if you want to end the practice of using the Rules Committee as a burial ground, then have regular meetings. But you can't have your cake and eat it too. Well, you can. but I'm going to call you on it.
But that'll make the mayor cry.
So, all right, let me ask you this. Oh, get ready for another duck and dodge. So what do you think is more legitimate? Her, quote, indignation at Raylo moving legislation to a committee to avoid discussion, or her tears of appreciation for Walter Burnett because he positioned her second only to God in the entire universe of things that he appreciates.
I don't think you disagree, Ben, that she was annoyed that Ray Lopez sent her appointment of Andrea Kirsten to rules. I don't think there's any, right?
So you think that's more legitimate? You think that was more of a real...
How could that not annoy her? You know?
I don't know. If you do the same thing, he's just doing what you do, and then you go...
That's not how that works.
I see. Okay.
Shall we move on?
Yes, sir.
Dennis, please, we're going to do staff next. Now I'd like to turn to a discussion in a November 15 Finance Committee meeting of a proposed settlement of a 10-year-old lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois over how the Chicago Police Department allocates cops throughout the city. This bit starts with Finance Committee Chair Alderman Scott Wagespack, and we'll hear Deputy Corporation Counsel Jeff Levine describe the proposed settlement. Let's listen.
If you want to move on to C, Central Austin Neighborhood Association and ACLU of Illinois versus City of Chicago.
This case has been pending for a decade. This case was filed in 2011. It was brought by the ACLU of Illinois, also a group called the Central Austin Neighborhood Association. The lawsuit claims that the police department is in violation of the Illinois Civil Rights Act because there are alleged racial and ethnic disparities in the time it takes to respond to 911 calls for emergency services, and that these disparities are based on the population of the neighborhood or district served. The parties engaged in discovery, which was exceptionally voluminous because it included enormous amounts of data from the Office of Emergency Management and Communications, their computer-assisted dispatch system, a significant amount of documents related to staffing and deployment. In late 2016, the parties agreed to stay discovery and explore the possibility of settlement. During these discussions, the city entered into the federal consent decree. The consent decree's provisions relating to CPD staffing and unity of command form a mandatory overlay over other deployment considerations. The city commits to essentially three reporting obligations. The first is to set a benchmark goal for providing reports of responses to 911 calls and achieving a 70% reporting rate in 1 year and 80% within 3 years. That doesn't mean responding to 911 calls 70 and 80% of the time. It means filing a report that the call was responded to 70 and then 80%. The second reporting element is consideration of equity and response times in the formulation of the new CPD staffing plan. And the third element is electronic publication of certain data relating to calls for service.
Alderman Thompson?
We're agreeing in a settlement case on something that has an impact on the consent decree. Are those reconciled?
Taisha Dixon, Deputy Corporation Counsel for Public Safety. The consent decree requires that CPD undergo a pretty fulsome workforce study and analysis. This settlement would just require that CPD consider racial and ethnic disparities in doing that workforce assessment.
Listeners can hear additional comments from 15th Ward Alderman Ray Lopez in the extended version of this episode found at the Inside Chicago Government website, shygov.com. Ben, why I think this is notable: about the time that the ACLU sued the city over police staffing as related to response times in certain communities, our colleague, Mick Dumke, wrote a piece about this issue for the Chicago News Cooperative. So this is like 2011. Mm-hmm. In that piece, Dumke wrote, quote, "The department last made major alterations to its deployment strategy in 1978, when some beats were redrawn to reflect crime and demographic trends," unquote. So as far as I can tell, The police department hasn't officially changed the staffing levels of police beats since that time. However, the department is required, as we were hearing in this piece, to address staffing by the federal consent decree that it now operates under. But the federal consent decree's monitor had a report, her fourth quarter report said, although the city and the CPD have made efforts to engage staffing experts to assist in developing a staffing plan, the plan had not yet been developed, unquote. Finally, I'll say that, and maybe this is where you'd like to start, that moving cops from one part of the city to another is permanent staffing levels in particular districts has always been a political hot potato. Because, some aldermen, that means that some aldermen who feel ownership over the number of cops in the districts in their wards say that, no, you're not taking cops away from my ward.
Yeah, that's, by the way, I'm really glad you included this. This is a fascinating piece of Chicago history that reveals so much about the sort of the contradictory strands of debate that are constantly going on in Chicago. And I think this reveal, I would love to hear what Raylo had to say about it. I'm going to go check it out, check out Inside Chicago Government, get his extended comments, or just bring him on the show and get his thoughts on it. But, I've had this debate with my friends of the defund the police persuasion for a long time. And I am convinced that most people in the city of Chicago do not want the police defunded, but they want better trained police. They want a police department that's more representative of the city as a whole. They want actually police that would show the common sense that Ella French showed when she walked in and quickly realized that they had the wrong house with Anjanette Young. And Anjanette Young praised Ella French. So in this particular case, think about it, Dave. The essence of this lawsuit, which was just buried in the city for 10 years, was that residents of Austin wanted the same response time when they were facing a crisis as, let's say, residents of Lakeview. And they weren't getting it. And so you have, it's a contradiction in some ways, because on the other hand, you have people in the neighborhoods like Austin who say the few encounters they have with the police are unsatisfactory. They're treated like criminals when they're not. They're harassed. And so it's like, on one hand, they're saying we want more police. On the other hand, we're saying we want police who are not harassing us.
It depends who you ask, right?
Yeah.
The ACLU folks are activists trying to find equity and parity throughout the city, whereas the neighborhoods that are, quote, over-policed, unquote, don't want just more cops harassing, attending to them. They want cops to come when they call them.
Yes, and to investigate crimes. Yes, yeah. To come when they call.
And they just don't want to, hanging around and then stopping them.
Stopping them for, reefer stuff. Arresting them for something that white people are doing all the time.
Or for being black.
Yes. Smoking reefer while being black. And so I was just coincidentally talking to a dear friend of mine, and I'm not quite sure she would want me to use her name, so we'll just call her Sally Sue. And she is leaving. She's moving out of Chicago. She's selling her home in the 8th Ward and is going to move to a suburb. And part of the reason is crime. And coincidentally, the day after I talked to her, my beloved Bright One, the Chicago Sun-Times, did a story about the decline over the last 10 years in the population of black people in the city of Chicago. And one of the things they talk about, it was Austin, which has lost a significant number of its residents. And I think that just in general, the city of Chicago has been providing inadequate services to black communities. And it's not just like we talk about in terms of closing schools or closing clinics, but it's also with this disparity that's existed forever. And we wonder why, I think it's 85,000 black residents. The population of the Chicago's black community fell by 85,000. Don't quote me on that day, but I think it's 85,000 over the last decade. And I think this is very revealing. this particular. And so here we are. So 2011, Mayor Rahm was probably the mayor when the suit was filed, right? 2011, he was elected. Unless the suit was filed at the start of the 2011 year, then it was dated. The point is, this thing has dragged on for all these years, all these terms. It doesn't get a lot of attention, and they're finally going to resolve it. And it doesn't sound like they're going to resolve it anytime soon by bringing better trained police officers to respond to Austin. Does not sound like that's part of the resolution. Not quite sure what, based on that jargon that the bureaucrat uttered at that hearing, what they're going to do, but looks like they're going to resolve it one way or the other.
Well, one of the ways that this might get resolved is through the consent decree, because of the as I mentioned, the consent decree does have provisions for staffing. And we heard Alderman Patrick Daley Thompson of the 11th Ward talk about or ask, you know, how does this, does it interfere? Does it complement? And we heard Mr. Levine from the law department say, well, it's sort of an overlay of what the consent decree requires. And in fact, the as I read from the monitors, the consent decree monitors report, the police department is supposed to address staffing to come into compliance with the consent decree. But according to the monitor's last report, has not moved on that. Now, there are other reports that say that the police department has engaged the University of Chicago Crime Lab to conduct a study, and we've read some reports, unofficial reports about that, but so far I haven't been able to get the police department to give me any information on that.
Well, I'm definitely going to bring my friend on if she's willing to do it, actually. And we'll talk about this issue further, because that was part of her lament, that there doesn't seem to be an adequate response to crime. And this has been a theory or theme that I've read for years. And Mick Dumke, we'll give a shout out to our dear friend Mick Dumke, was the one advancing this many years ago, long before it was fashionable, that in the absence of investigations and solving crimes, there's no accountability. And so people feel they can get away with crimes. I just contrast the amount of police force and power that went into investigating Jussie Smollett and his alleged, put alleged in there, crime against the city. And that's the part that just blows my mind. It's almost comical. The hours and hours of detective work that went in, and they built this incredible case against Jussie Smollett. They had the store where the rope was purchased and everything. And yet people in Austin are talking about response times. It's like serious crimes, shootings, et cetera, and so forth, break-ins. And so, yeah, this, it just seems like our city, its priorities are askew.
There's plenty of room for outrage.
Yes. All right. What's next, young man?
Dennis, please, we're going to do Ward next. Ben, as you're aware, city ordinance requires the city council to approve by December 1, which is tomorrow, a new ward map that takes into account how the city's population has shifted based on the 2020 census. Ben, can you give us a quick thumbnail of what happens if the council doesn't approve a new ward map by December 1? 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, they... if they don't approve a ward map with a certain number of votes, I think it's 41, don't quote me on that, then there's a referendum. And the people of the city of Chicago get to determine what is the governing map. And we live through, I'm doing it off the top of my head, we live through such a referendum. I don't know if, Dave, if you lived in Chicago back then. I want to say in 1992 or 3.
I heard you on the radio recently describing this.
Yes, but I had my notes in front of me, and I don't have them in front of me now. So I look so smart.
You prepare for WVON. You prepare for heat, is that what you're saying?
Well, as we said at the start of the show, young Dave, this is all improvised.
Well, you did ask me if we were going to talk about this.
Yeah, but I didn't know you were going to throw that one at me.
All right.
It was 19. If it was like a game show, I would go with 1992 was the year. And so it would be. But what I don't know, and I hope you can help me out here, but I did not know, and I still don't know, is how do they choose which two maps to go on the referendum? Dave, go. Let's go.
Don't know.
Oh. I thought you would.
One step at a time.
But I look for anything I can vote on. I love voting so much. I can't wait to get to vote on a ward map. I don't think they're going to get 41 votes tomorrow. So,
all right. Well, where we're at as of this recording is the council's Latino caucus has proposed its version of a ward map. A nonpartisan group, Change Illinois, formed what it called the Chicago Redistricting Advisory Commission that created its map based on resident input, where they actually went around the city and asked people, where, you know, how do you want your ward boundaries to be? And there is an effort by the council itself, led by Rules Committee Chair Alderman Michelle Harris, Michelle with two L's, that invites aldermen to go into a city council space called the Map Room, which is also a bar in Bucktown that I like quite a bit. The Map Room, to create a ward map based on what each individual alderman would like to see in terms of ward boundaries. A city council meeting for today to consider ward mapping was canceled. And a rules committee meeting on the subject is taking place as we speak.
A rules committee?
Yes. Fuck.
The aforementioned rules committee is kicking in the gear.
So I haven't checked in the last few minutes. It might be over by now, but it started at 1 o'clock. And then finally two, not one, but two city council meetings are scheduled for December 1, one at 10 a.m. and one at 1 p.m. With all that said, we'll now hear audio from a November 18th meeting of the Rules Committee that was called to question the makers of the Latino Caucus's proposed map. Let's listen.
What are my numbers in 24?
Please stop. Sorry, Dennis. This starts with 24th Ward Alderman Michael Scott of the South Side in an exchange. Well, you know, we could have that debate. Where's the South Side start and where's the West Side start? Because I just saw in the newspaper, tangentially, 19th Street called the West Side. And I was like, what?
Okay, Michael anyway. Scott is very much a West Sider. His daddy was, may he rest in peace, was a West Sider. And Michael Scott Jr., 24th Ward Alderman, used to run Douglas Park, little known trivia. Huh. And so
anyway, the Park District.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No lifeguards there, presumably.
There may be a swimming pool.
This will be an exchange between Scott and a guy named Frank Calabrese, the cartographer who created the Latino Caucus map. And that actually is an proposed ordinance, 02021-4835. And I'll note that the 24th Ward borders are roughly Cicero on the west, Kedzie on the east, Harrison on the north, Cermak on the south, but it has a gerrymandered appendage on the southeast that hooks down to include pretty much just Cook County Jail. So now, let's listen.
What are my numbers in 24 as it relates to this map? How many African Americans?
The 24th ward would be a 73% black ward.
So you take out the jail because you take out that hook portion. You take me further east, and the boundaries on the east side would be where?
Roughly the medical campus.
I know the further you go east, the less African-American you become.
That's correct. But there's also some very African-American areas around Middle Adams Park.
What percentage of the ones that you took out were African-American out of that hook part?
It's only the Cook County Jail.
That's African-American that you took out?
Correct.
All right. That decreases me from 81 to about, you said, to 73?
In our proposal, you'd be a 73% black ward, and you would be 12% Latino, 9% white.
Alderman Moore.
The 17th ward, you said, was a 70% Latino population. You're going to take a 70% black ward and disenfranchise them and make it a 70% Latino ward. That's what you're telling me, right?
First off, we're not disenfranchising anyone. And secondly, we're, again.
Was the 17th ward a 70% black ward?
Yes.
And now it's a 70% Latino ward, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you're disenfranchising 70% of black people, correct?
Respectfully, we're taking into account doing population shifts in the last 10 years. And so the map was drawn not as a snapshot of 10 years ago, but as a live view of the most recent census data. So
10% population was lost. Even if it was all 10% Black, which I'm sure it wasn't, you still a 60% Black population, which is a majority. And so you're basically taking a majority Black ward and flipping it into a majority Latino ward, disfranchisement to the Black community.
Alderman Villegas?
We would love to get this done before December 1st. We still have time to do that.
We still do. Come on in the room and join us.
Absolutely. The only problem is that we got to make sure that we get in the room, that we're talking and compromising.
And for a person who's done this for the second time in her career, I think that's what the map room is all about. Nobody gets what they want in the mapping. When you have to move your lines and you have to move geography, everybody's in a compromising situation. So I'm asking everybody to come in the space and compromise, but you can't compromise if we all aren't sitting in the room doing it together. So I implore you to come on in that room so that we can all get to a point where we get to 41, and I think 41 is really close. I have this policy that when you're drawing, I don't sit in till you finish, and then I'll come in and take a look, but I'm happy to sit in on anybody's mapping process that wants me to do that. I think that we're going to have a long weekend this weekend. I think we should work all weekend to get to 41. So again, I want to welcome everybody into this map room so that we can finish up this map before December 1st.
Well, I have some things to say about that, but where would you like to start then?
Well, I want to start by just pointing something out that has nothing to do with the tapes you play, but I'm going to take this opportunity next Tuesday. First Tuesday returns to the Hideout, and we'll be discussing the new ward map. Maya Dukmasafa and I will be back at the Hideout. So if you want to check it out, I urge you to come. Candace Castillo, a brilliant political analyst who comes on our show all the time, will be our guest, and we'll be breaking down the new. We were originally going to be we're probably going to talk about a lot of legislative maps, but I got a feeling most of the emphasis will be on the new ward map. So first Tuesday, next Tuesday at the Hideout, 6:30. I've been negligent in not doing a better job of promoting that. Wow, there's so much to break out here. There's just so much. And you're right. I was with the great Atibu Buchanan yesterday on his show on WVON talking about this. And just the notion that is so prevalent in the city of Chicago, David Moore, alderman of the 17th Ward, talks about Black residents being disenfranchised if they're in a ward that is majority Hispanic or Latino. And that notion gets back to this point, which emerged from the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, voting rights legislation. In the city of Chicago, if a ward did not have a supermajority of Black residents, then the alderman would then the ward would probably elect a white alderman who would be openly hostile to the needs of his or her Black constituents. And that is just the underlying assumption in legislation that was passed in Congress about civil rights, voting rights law. That was the underlying assumption in lawsuits filed against the city of Chicago in 1981 or 82 regarding ward maps. And then in 91 and 92, the notion that if Black residents did not have a supermajority of Black people in a ward, their rights would be trampled on. And I believe that. I absolutely believe that in the context of 1970s and the 1980s and the 1990s. I have subsequently, Dave, been following the city council and their actions for the last 40 years almost. Can you believe that? Particularly in regards to the TIF program and the disbursement of economic development dollars. And I see absolutely no significant difference between any alderman of any color when it comes to challenging the mayor on the disbursement of money that's intended for the Black community or poor Hispanic communities or blighted communities. So I throw this out there as a challenge, and I did it with Atiba on his show. What difference does it make who your alderman is or what color he is or what ethnicity he or she is if they're only going to do what the mayor tells them in the first place?
So there's two presumptions here. One is that, as you say, the race or the ethnicity of the alderman is correlated to how much they represent a certain ethnic group in a ward. That's one presumption. And another one, which is equally striking to me, is that each alderman is sort of entitled to keep whatever sets of constituents they already have, which is, you know, just for round numbers, like roughly 54,000, you know, because they're trying to balance the wards to be roughly equivalent. And we saw that, we heard that in this clip, that, you know, there's a lot of like, so you're moving me, you're moving my boundaries, you know, this is like the presumption, it sounds like the presumptive on the parts of the alderman that this is my area. And what you are doing is you're doing it to me, not to my constituents.
Well, David Moore actually said they were going to be disenfranchising black residents of the 17th Ward. He used that word. They were taking away their franchise. They were going to take away their rights.
I'm sorry. I think I was talking about Michael Scott.
Yeah.
Probably. He's using that language more than David Moore does.
Yeah. And but essentially, what aldermen may invoke a great theme or principle, like disenfranchising black voters. But more often than not, an alderman is talking about disenfranchising them. If you move precincts out of an alderman's ward, and this is what I was talking about with the TB yesterday, that the alderman has worked. But we were talking about this with the 9th ward, Anthony Beal in Pullman. He's very upset because the ward map is proposing to move Pullman out of his 9th ward. And if you move precincts out of an alderman's ward, precincts that he has cultivated, precincts where he knows the block leaders, precincts where he's worked with community reps and he has a strong affinity for them. If you move them out of his ward and another person's ward, you're taking away that person's base of support. Suddenly they're vulnerable.
Vulnerable to not being reelected.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. So the person you're disenfranchising is the alderman. You're threatening the political existence of the local alderman.
So all this is based on some level on incumbency and the desire to protect incumbency on the part of the incumbents, right?
Yeah, so well, I would go ahead. I'm not going to agree to that because there's a principle that goes back to the racial history of Chicago in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and into the 90s in which black residents were disenfranchised. When the Daily Machine and Harold Washington tried to stop this, but the Daily Machine would pack many black people as it could into a handful of wards and then carefully disperse white population in such a way that white people would control the other wards. And that is how they undercut the power of the black community. There's a whole history of this. And that's why these lawsuits were filed in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s. But I've watched subsequently the changes in Chicago. And they're not all good changes, Dave, where I watch black aldermen routinely vote against the economic interests of their wards when they support the mayor on these economic development plans. I'm not even going to say TIF, because as soon as I say TIF, people will stop listening. So I'll just say economic development. And so that's why I raise this question.
Well, so you're not disagreeing with me that, first of all, I agree with your read on the history of, you know, why these, you know, protected, or they're called, what do they call, protected classes? I can't remember what the lingo is. That's why they existed. But today, my point was that today, I think the key motivator is protecting incumbency.
Yes, and there was always an intersection between incumbency and these larger issues. You're absolutely correct. So, for instance, you might have two black aldermen sparring over like a neighborhood or a little cluster of precincts because they each claim title to the precincts. So there's not a larger civil rights or a racial issue there. It's a matter of protecting an incumbent. So whenever you start dividing up a map, you're absolutely correct. Protecting incumbents becomes sort of a prime motivating factor influencing the votes of the alderman. You're absolutely correct in that point. And a lot of the posturing that we're hearing in the city council right now has to do with aldermen worried about being mapped out of existence like they did to our dear friend Robert Fioretti, as you recall, in the back in 2011. Good God, time flies.
Long time ago, second ward.
Mm-hmm. So you're right. It's a lot of it is aldermen worried about their political future, worried about their whether they can get reelected. And that's at heart a good portion of this, what this squabble is all about.
So would in this context, what do you think about term limits for aldermen?
Wow, there's a question I wasn't anticipating.
Because if the problem is like aldermen protecting their incumbency, if they're afraid they're not going to get reelected if you change their constituents, which, you know, take these, like you say, these precincts that they've worked so hard at, what if you take away that motivation?
Well, you know, I am all over the map when it comes to term limits. I was vehemently opposed to them for years. And then one day I went and had breakfast with Pat Quinn, and he talked me into signing his petition calling on term limits for mayor, which I think passed. I think you raise a very good point.
That passed? The General Assembly?
No. What happened was, okay, now it's one of my favorite tangents of all time.
I always wanted, because after Mayor Emanuel was gone, so did Pat Quinn and his.
Well, here's what happened.
Petition.
Oh my God! Do we have an hour for me to go on this one? Because it's one of my favorite.
We'll make this the last.
Okay. So what happened was, Pat Quinn dutifully collected enough signatures to get it on the ballot, and I signed it. I just want to let you know, after spending all those years railing against term limits, I signed it.
Just to be clear, this is to limit Chicago or any municipality's mayor in Illinois to two terms.
No, it's just to Chicago.
It was just Chicago.
For Chicago, okay. Two terms. And
not at all aimed at Rahm Emanuel.
Totally aimed at Rob. Although Pat Quinn will go, no, Ben, no, I'm just quoting Quinn.
Yeah.
Okay, Pat. Anyway, I signed it and enjoyed a delicious breakfast with Pat Quinn. It was a very enjoyable time. And I signed his petition, wrote a column about it. And then eventually lawyers that were essentially representing Rahm's interest tied it up in court. I think it was the Supremes ruled against Pat Quinn. And they some technicality that they used to bury this thing. But they couldn't rule on it before the election happened. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So what the Board of Elections in its infinite wisdom decided to do was, while this matter is being adjudicated, they kept it on the ballot and we got to vote on it as a people. And then the determination was what to do with those votes. And so they just said, like, the votes are off the record. Oh, this is only in Chicago. This is the mentality of this gets back to the whole thing with Andrea Kirsten. Well, we don't like what the report said, so let's just edit that out of the report. What? You're just going to... So you don't like what the election was. We're not going to tell you what... So that's why I always say whenever Pat Quinn comes on the show, I go, Pat, I'll bet you anything your referendum passed, probably passed overwhelmingly, but they won't tell us.
But the reports about the Kennedy assassination will come out before the reports of this vote. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well put. So
term limits.
So term limits. You know what? I'm going to go for a walk tonight and think about it because make a valid point. I've argued that with the city council, I've advanced this notion and been clobbered whenever I do that we just have a computer draw the map. Just make sure fit. Don't worry about neighborhoods. I always hear about this neighborhood has to be. Why? Why does one whole neighborhood have to be in one whole ward? I don't
know. Look at police districts. You know, police districts aren't really gerrymandered. They're pretty regular and compact, like zip codes. You know?
Yeah. So anyway, I put that out there, and I always get clobbered by the alderman when I suggest that. But you're essentially saying that if there's a term limit, you take out all political considerations. So they would effectively, then the argument would become like one of the most contiguous maps that you can draw, that they resemble something looking like a square. Which ones keep communities together so you don't just divide like West Town or, you know,
yeah, incumbency is just it is the one sort of bad influence on our democracy, and I grasp for solutions, and term limits is one solution that probably there are plenty of arguments that I'd love to have with you about it at some other point, but yeah, I'm just like
that's a good point. I'll think about that. I'll ponder it. while I'm walking tonight.
Maybe we'll have a segment on term limits sometime. Well, I don't think we're going to play any more audio, but I just want to throw one more thing at you, unrelated. This is something that happened recently. We talked not too long ago about the departure of the longtime Chicago Inspector General Joe Ferguson. And recently, the person who Ferguson appointed to head the Office of Inspector General's Public Safety Section, named Deborah Wartzberg, announced that she is resigning that post because she wants to be considered to be Ferguson's replacement. And I'll just read a quote that she, from her letter of resignation, she said, she's pursuing the top inspector general's job, and she wants to, quote, avoid any appearance or concern that the work of the section, meaning the public safety section she's the head of, might be influenced by my candidacy for a mayoral appointment, unquote. So here we had, what's interesting to me is we just had the inspector general not get his appointment renewed by the mayor for whatever reason. And then one of his top people willingly resigns so that she can run for his, she can be considered for his position. I'm just wondering if you have any comments on that.
Well, did Ferguson resign his position before he was not reappointed? I know that makes no sense. I can't recall.
We listened to Alderman Anthony Beal, the Ninth Ward, question him at a committee meeting, like, were you asked to stay? And the chair, Alderman Pat Dowell, tried to get him to not ask that question. But Beal did say, were you asked to stay? And Ferguson said, no.
Yeah.
So he got the message, and he left at the end of his term.
My attitude in general is that I'm very skeptical about any mayoral appointee having any independence in this town. And the inspector general office was a joke for years and years. And then David Hoffman, who was appointed by Mayor Daley back in the O's, was critical of the mayor's parking meter deal.
Well, of staking out independence.
Yeah. By being critical of the mayor's parking meter deal and enraging Mayor Daley, Hoffman did two things. One, he elevated his profile so much that he could run for Senate. And I think if the election campaign season had been a week longer, he would have beat, in my humble opinion, Giannoulis, but whatever.
Interesting.
That was back in 2010. But also he set a precedent that from there on out, the inspector general's office would be independent.
Joe Ferguson, his successor, took that even further.
Yes, I think I'll give Joe Ferguson credit. I disagree completely with this letter he wrote regarding ROM, but that letter was written after Joe Ferguson had left that position. And so for the most part, I say that Joe Ferguson carried on that tradition of having an independent inspector general. So here we are, Dave. And Lori Lightfoot has just been openly expressing her irritation with Joe Ferguson. And as to your point, made it clear that she wasn't going to reappoint him. So now it looks like we're heading back to the pre-David Hoffman era, where inspector generals were more sort of like mayoral appointees to the school board. Or think of it this way. They're more like Alderman Walter Burnett in their attitude to the mayor, in which the mayor is second only to God in terms. Thank goodness he didn't reverse that. So they do it. Every inspector general from here on out will have to give a pledge of allegiance to the mayor.
So do you think it was naive for Ms. Wartzberg, Ms. Wartzberg, to instead of just like sticking around and, you know, pretty much assuring that she's going to be around for a while, leaving and then hoping that the mayor is going to look favorably upon appointing her?
I can't answer that question because I don't know what the mayor's mind is like and things like this. And clearly, Deborah Wartzberg is playing some the game as she understands how it should be played, you know, the palace game, if you will. So I don't know the answer to your question on that one. I do know that the whole thing is filled with conflicts of interest. So she's trying to avoid a conflict of interest in an appointment process that is itself a conflict of interest, because the person that appoints you is the person you're kind of be investigating. And so it's sort of like, I don't really know how you apply for such a job.
And then perhaps the Chicago Board of Education and Chicago Public Schools is a model here, because as I understand it, the Inspector General at Chicago Public Schools is not appointed by the CEO, or formerly called the superintendent of schools. It's reports to the board,
I hesitate to call the Chicago public schools a model for anything. But I just saw what happened with the Park District, where Nathan Kipp was Deputy Inspector General doing an investigation into sexual assault complaints, and all of a sudden he was fired. No one's ever given an explanation. And so more and more, it's become the fashion to assign investigations to outside law firms. This is like a trend that's developing. We saw it at the Park District with the sexual assault case. Mayor Lori Lightfoot went that route with Anjanette Young. They've not released a report, but she signed a former judge to take a look at that. And so I feel as though that's the trend anyway.
And then one of the troubling things about this was pointed out by former IG Joe Ferguson. And we listened to a while back testimony he gave at city council about this. And he said one of the insidious aspects of that is that when the inspector general then comes in and wants to find out what that, you know, if they're doing an investigation on the same subject that the outside law firm is doing, he said that the administration in one particular case cited attorney-client privilege in whatever records they gave to the outside law firm to justify that why they couldn't give it to the inspector general.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really insidious.
It's an imperfect system. Even if you had an elected, I could argue, well, maybe we should just have the inspector general as a publicly elected body in your position, so they have to run for the... I would probably rather have that than what we have now. But
we got 7,000 units of elected, 7,000 units of government in Illinois. Why not add another one?
The more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned with elections. They were just talking about, I'm looking forward to the referendum on the Warren map. Are you kidding? So any way you look at it, it's an imperfect situation. And if you read Chicago history, the stories of inspector generals, in some cases in the Daley administration, old man Daley, going way back. I mean, taking phone calls from the mob. They weren't literally inspector generals then. They had a different title, but they were their assignment was to rout out corruption. So we have a sordid history, to put it mildly, when it comes to objective overseers of Chicago government. And I don't think that's going to change anytime
soon. Well, and let's hope that we haven't seen the peak and now we're in a decline in terms of corruption busting, because that's a fear of mine.
Yes, I think that's a legitimate concern to have. We just, in this show, we'll close by saying in 2 points. One, the mayor sternly reprimanding while patting on the head Kirsten. Doing two things at once, sending a, that's a mixed message of itself. And then this whole situation where she lets Joe Ferguson know that he's not wanted. So that sends a message to whoever's following you better polish the mayor's apple. So anybody looking for that inspector general job, my first advice to you is call Alderman Walter Burnett and ask him for tips on how to talk to Mayor Lori Lightfoot.
Because he knows.
He knows. He knows how to talk to her in such a way that brings tears to her eyes, ladies and gentlemen.
That's all you need.
That's all you need. All right, Dave Gloetz, thank you very much. You did an excellent job, as you always do.
Thank you. And if I may add, if listeners want to hear more, they can hear an extended version of this episode at the Inside Chicago Government website, which is at shygov.com, and follow Inside Chicago Government on Facebook at facebook.com/InsideGov. Follow Inside Chicago Government on Twitter at CHIGOVT. And my thanks to you very much, Ben, and thanks to Dennis for all the tech heck. Great job.
Yes, Dennis does a great job. Thank you very much, Dave Glowatz. And again, thanks, man, the myth, the legend, the prior joy, all Illinois, without whom the show would be possible. And as Dave Glowatz, Walter Burnett, and Joe Ferguson will tell you, back home in Alton, they call him Dr. D. Give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.